run down and tell the press what to do. But this time, somebody made a decision that we were going to really expose ourselves to the press. And I tell you, we've never done clams in a fishbowl the way we did here. They were crawling all over us. I guess we must have averaged each an hour or two a day just answering questions of reporters. There were 400 or 500 of them there at the peak. Now it's kind of slow. There's only a couple of guys down there, but at the peak, they just about drove us up. And of course, the last part was the actual trying to figure out what the data meant, especially the data that helped us to make any decisions that had to be made. You remember the time we were poking around the rocks, and our arm was working one moment and not working the next and so forth. We were running pretty scared at that time that we'd lose the capability of sampling. And so a lot of my time in particular was spent making sure that whatever we did get in the way of pictures or data or anything else that could help answer questions, operational questions, that we did it. I went through an awful lot of scientists in that time, people who collapsed for one reason or another, or had families that got pulled apart. But most of us survived one way or another. Take any more?
Tom, do you have any more from that end or Don?
Yeah, I guess if someone else has got one, I've got one for you. Jimmy, tell me why 1.5% argon turns you on.
Well, any argon turns me on. It isn't just the argon itself. That argon comes from the 1.5% that you're talking about, comes from potassium. The way argon, well, I've got to go back just a little bit, Tom. To the beginning. As you know, argon is one of the noble gases. It's one of the gases that doesn't react with anything else. It doesn't freeze out, it doesn't boil away, it's simply there. It's kind of a, well, that's why it's called a noble gas, inactive substance. In that sense, it's kind of a time marker for what happens. That argon, 1.5% that I talked about, which is argon-40, is the result of the decay of potassium-40. That is, potassium, which is radioactive, loses electrons. It goes from potassium-40 to argon-40. And in so doing, tells us something about how long the amount of argon that's there must have been there in order to be that amount of potassium-40. So already we're beginning to see something about the dating of the planet. Now, so far, you know, I'm off on a limb here. Because they haven't published what their results are, but it's looking now like that planet is clearly about the same age as the Earth. Now, you know, you might have said I knew that before, but nobody really did know that before. That was just conjecture. More importantly, it is the ratio of that amount of argon, the argon-40, to the natural argon, the actual argon-36. And it's those two ratios that tell us something about the outgas. Same sense that I described the nitrogen 14 and 15 working, so the argon 36 and the argon 40, their separation and the ratios between them tell us something about the existence of. So if you go back, you say, well, how much argon must there have been at the beginning, and how much argon is there now? Therefore, how long has this gas been there? What fraction of it is there now? What fraction must there have been at the beginning? And what it does is it gives you an inventory of reconstructing not so much what gas, but how much gas there was there at various points in time. And it's that we base this notion about the flowing water on. It's clear that there's been flowing water on Mars. And that can't have happened in the last billion years. And so we're trying very hard to pinpoint when those events happened, see whether it was just a single episode or whether it was a whole class of episodes that took place. Next guy?
44 has a couple more, I can take it.
Go ahead, 44.
Okay. We all hope you get the Viking rover mission. I'm just wondering, in the light of the knowledge we have at the moment, what experiments you'd carry on that, particularly those which might look for non-Earth-type life, and would you go for microscopes and things of this kind, perhaps?
Well, the rover mission, I want to make sure you understand, the rover mission, nobody yet has approved it. That doesn't mean they haven't approved it. We just don't know where it stands. So let's talk about it as though it's going to happen because, you know, whether we talk about it in 81 or 84 or whatever it is, there's going to be a rover mission on Mars. There's no question in my mind at all. The kind of experiments we're talking about now are really kind of two classes. One you just mentioned, and I'll come back to those two. There's a class of experiment that says, take the Viking data you've got, and now tell us what kind of chemical, biological, or otherwise experiments you'd like to develop. And there are a bunch of guys that meet about once a week now. We start once every 2 weeks, trying to understand what the next set of questions are, whether it's for us to answer or the next generation to answer. We're the ones right now that have all the data, and we ought to set down what we believe are the next set of questions. That group has begun to think about a pretty ambitious instrument. It's called a unified chemical instrument. And what it does is it uses one central detector, and it has modules, sort of like the way airports have satellite areas for each of the various airline companies. This would have a central detection system and a variety of satellite modules, each performing a different experiment, but all feeding in for analysis to the major mother experiment center. It's a pretty ambitious idea, but one has to do if we're going to, after all, we humans aren't going to be there for a while. You're going to get a machine to try to do what people normally do in laboratories. It would be able to carry out oxidation reduction experiments. It would have a way of reacting various solutions. It would have a way of extracting, performing kind of basically those chemical things that either you or your kids are doing in school these days, which is sort of chemical analysis on a rather grand and high plane. Now, the other direction that the rovers people are pushing that rover is to really understand the visual aspects. We've had those first pictures, and it's clear that we can build a good camera. And it's also clear that the pictures, we may have underestimated the interest in the pictures. I've never seen so much interest generated just by what things look like. Not only among press, which is obvious to the public, but among scientists. Scientists who before had poo-pooed the notion of, well, after you've taken one picture of Mars, you've seen it all. It's not that way. They can hardly wait. Every time there's another picture to come in, these guys come running down here in the middle of the night, and they sit around and monitor, and they, and odd. You think that every rock was a personal friend of theirs when they learn anything. And I think what we're going to likely do is expand and try to understand how best to use that whole concept of imaging. Obviously, microscopes are one end of it. Long-distance imaging is the other end of it. We're a large number of people now interested in looking in the infrared to try to understand something about how what kind of chemistry is there by looking at the infrared. Don't be shy. Step up to the microphone.
Jerry, done great.
Hi, Don.
At one stage there was information passed out that there appeared to be a salt deposit or something of that nature, as if water had evaporated off and left a deposit. Did you ever get to sample anything like that?
Well, that's an interesting thing. We never really saw visually what we expected to find as salt deposits. We saw an area that looked kind of crusty, and we said maybe there is a salt deposit there. It was an area we lovingly grew to call Bonneville. Any of you who've been to the States, you remember Bonneville Flats. And we thought that was going to be the salty area. And we did get the sample there. We were very happy with what we sampled. But it turns out we didn't find any of those salts that we anticipated might be there. Now let me, though, not drop the subject of salt, because a very curious thing happened, quite independent of Bonneville. We discovered, among the chemistry, an enormous amount of sulfur. Now, sulfur can be in a variety of forms. One thing we also discovered about that sulfur is it's not in a free state. It would have ruined our GCMS, and we know it's not free sulfur. Based upon the way that chemistry works, we also discovered it can't be sulfide or sulfite. It's not iron sulfide. It's not foolable, for example. And when you put it all together, it looks now as though it's more like magnesium sulfate, which we know is gypsum. Now, why there's so much gypsum in the soil, and there's an enormous amount of it, it's still kind of baffled. One explanation is those may be the results of old depositions of salt beds that have been leached out. What we're looking at is may not look like an ocean to us, but it may have been some kind of an ancient collection basin at one time. For one thing, there sure is an awful lot of sulfur there compared to what we expected.
John Saxon 44 again, don't want to monopolize this, just cut me off if necessary, but...
Not at all, I'm happy to answer.
Got a couple more here from people around. The first one is geological, and we're wondering if from all the work from the orbiters and what you've seen so far of the planet, whether you have seen anything to indicate that a lot of the events that are occurring now, or the current situation of the planet tends to point towards everything happening as a single event in the past, particularly in relation to Valakoski's theory of Venus coming from Jupiter and or maybe a large comet doing a close pass past Mars and causing a lot of stuff to happen at one time in the past.
You really want to know whether I think there was any great colossal event that took place at one time.
Right.
Certainly there's no evidence of that. We see an awful lot of events that have taken place. There is at least two lines of evidence that suggest the stuff is episodic in nature. That it takes place, and then it takes place another way, and then it takes place. One is in the picture, and those of you who've got copies of the picture, or if you look at the picture that's this one up on the wall, look at the sand dune. You notice on Lander 1, that picture that has, I think it's got the meteorology moon standing right up in the middle of the picture, kind of. But behind that, there's these obviously beautiful sand. In fact, we've stopped calling them sand dunes. They look more like drifts. They look like a sand drift more than a dune. If you look very carefully at those dunes, you'll find areas in which there clearly is evidence of layering. You can see, like a layered cake, you can see layers along the edge. Now, that's suggestive of a truly episodic event. Now, it's true those episodic events may have been short-lived, but at least it tells us that Mars is undergoing changes from one period of time to another. The other thing, of course, is the polar regions. The polar regions, when you see the pictures of the poles, I realize you don't have that yet, you will see additional evidence for these episodic events. Now, I really haven't answered your question because I haven't said that no, there could not be have been some colossal event in the past that's caused the formation of an awful lot of what we've seen. But at least along with scientists that I ran into in the hall, I don't find anybody who believes this happened on one big super time. Most of them believe this happened over long periods of time, and what we're seeing is really pretty old.
Well, that certainly answered the question. Thank you. The last one was the way it's put to me was: were any experiments conducted in the dark period to look for nocturnal life? And I guess what we're saying is you went to a great deal of trouble to simulate Martian sunlight and things like that within some of the experiments. Were any experiments run without that simulation or dark time?
Right. In fact, one of the biology experiments, as you remember, had that simulated sunlight inside, and we did run it in the dark one of the times. In fact, on Viking 2, the first time we ran it in the dark rather than the light, just to see what would happen. And it turns out about the same happened as when it was in the light. In fact, that's one of the more perplexing things, why we don't understand this biology. Since the reaction happened the same way in the dark as in the light, we decided that maybe the thing is not due to photochemistry, maybe it's due to some sort of active chemistry. We then went on to try to sterilize that same experiment and run it again. And sure enough, it went down significantly. That is, whatever we were doing, whether we were actually killing organisms or changing chemistry, we sure did affect it by heating it up. But so far we see no strong evidence that the light affects that experiment one way or the other.
Have you actually made any biological, any collections in the dark of the night rather than in sunlight, Jerry?
The first collection we did was done at night.
Okay.
In fact, if you remember the time we got the arm stuck very early in the first mission, that was a collection that took place in the middle of the night. Since that time, we've always collected in the daytime, and we're going to go back on the last dig, the one that's coming up, and actually the one under the rock now is going to be done at 6 o'clock in the morning. So we've sort of collected around the clock. We've collected high noon, close to high noon, about 11 o'clock in the morning. We've collected in the middle of the night. We're going to do this last one at dawn. Did you like that picture of the sunset? Wasn't that something? That beautiful picture that shows the casting of the sunlight from behind a very dark image of Mars.
That's one that they're going to run some reproductions of down here. Some of the people at the station have asked for, and we're going to have some made commercially, and the people here will pay for that.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite pictures. Let me tell you something about it for those of you who do get your hands on a copy of it. That picture, well, it's artistically very beautiful. It's turned out to be one of the most valuable scientific pictures we've taken, because what we use that for is measuring the size of the particles that are causing the scattering of that light. We know exactly where the sun was by the timing that was established, and therefore, by measuring the amount of light intensity and the angles of that light with respect to the spreading of the light, we can actually make deductions about the size of particles. We know the particles now that are floating in there are of the 20 to 200 micron size particles. Very interesting to take a picture like that. I think you can measure down the size of things that are cigarette smoke. Anybody else?
4-3. I just ask a question, reference weather again, and your organic experiments. Are you hopeful of some change of your organic measurements due to probably windborne material? As we all are well aware of, Mars has had violent storms in the past.
Well, unfortunately, that's one of our shortcomings in Viking. We only had two ovens on each lander. As you remember, we started out with three and lost one at launch. And as we discovered that just about the time we launched, the one oven on each lander. In fact, I was in Australia when that big flap took place. When I came back here, there was pandemonium breaking out. I'll come back to that story in just a moment. But at any rate, we ended up with only two ovens on each lander. And we have consumed now all four ovens. We haven't got the data back from the last one yet, all the data. There's still two temperatures to run. But we don't have another oven to use. There was only two on each lander. We decided to use them on this side of conjunction in case we didn't pick up a spacecraft on the other side. Let me tell you what happened when I was in Australia. That's kind of a funny story. You realize the life of Project Scientist is sometimes kind of funny. While I was there, Marshall and I got this strange call about the great galactic ghoul. And it became very garbled, and I never did understand what was going on back here in the States about a great galactic ghoul. And as it turns out, one of the reporters for the Washington Post had written a story that involved a mythological creature that started out on Mariner, one of the earlier Mariner missions that had gotten about the place that our Viking was when I was in Australia visiting you. And we lost some, we had some problem with one of the Mariners. Well, that same reporter had talked to one of the JPL guys, and they kind of, to make light of the thing, invented the Great Galactic Ghoul. And they said, the spacecraft is passing through the area where the Great Galactic Ghoul is. Now, about the time I was in Australia, our spacecraft was in that same area. At that same time, they were running a test on this GCMS to see how the three, we thought three ovens were. And lo and behold, they discovered that one of the ovens, the one that we had thought we launched with three, had really been launched with only two good ones and a bad one. And that same reporter wrote a story about the great galactic ghoul taking a bite out of Viking. Well, the experimenter was absolutely fit to be tied. He just came unglued at that. And wrote letters to NASA headquarters, threatened the newspapers with liable suits. When I came back here, I tell you, it was a fun place to be.
Jenny, tell me, they'll get one final one from me at least. As I understand it, the puzzling aspect of the chemistry is that there's both oxidation and reduction. Now, bizarrely, the peroxides could be causing the oxidation, but what's causing the reduction?
Tom, I don't know. I give my soul to know the answer to that question. There's no question we've seen photoreduction take place. The only way I know photoreduction to take place is biology. We've, as you know, gone through all sorts of textbooks and things. We've hired about every expert we can get our hands on to tell us how we can get photoreduction in the absence of biology. They've invented a few things on the blackboard saying, well, maybe you could be seeing this, maybe you could be seeing that. But so far, none of them have been demonstrated in the laboratory. It just doesn't make sense. Not in the light of all the oxidation that's taking place. But I guess, you know, that's not the first time that Bennett has been stuck with the paradox that later on there was an obvious reason to.
Chris Devitt, 4-3.
Right.
Is there any type of life on Earth that may survive in Mars? And would you consider sending it up there to propagate, if so?
Well, not for a while. I have no doubt at all that there'll be men walking around on Mars. If you call men life, that's certainly proof. But someday, maybe not in our lifetime, but I have no doubt at all that we're not only going to have spacecraft sent there sometime or another, but we're going to get samples back and we're going to be sending men there. And I don't doubt that, but we'll have a symphony on Mars someday. You know, give me enough time and I can do anything. But I think for the while, nobody's interested in sending any life there. The main reason is we really don't know whether it could literally contaminate the planet and screw up any further chances of looking for life there. So for the while, I think we're going to continue to send sterile spacecraft there to make sure that nobody's any living creature. But if things could live there, well, I suspect the answer to that's probably yes. I'd like to know a little more about that oxidizing power that I keep talking about. But there are plenty of organisms here that would be put under those conditions, probably would survive. They probably wouldn't grow very much, but I would expect they would survive.
SPB, any questions from there? Deacon, any questions from there?
Sounds like we've had a rich hour.
Yeah, okay.
Deacon has no questions. We've been watching this with a great deal of interest, and but most of the questions that we had have already been answered, I'm afraid.
I've
just got one last one from 44, and that concerns, well, it's two really. Firstly, how long do you feel it will take to reduce what data we have? Well, at what point in time do we feel that the curve will taper off so that it's not worth doing much more work? And secondly, does Dr. Soffan want to continue with Mars after that point in time, or are you thinking of going to transferring your interest to Venus or one of the other planets? Mr. 44, do you read me, Walt?
Yeah, I read you. I don't know if anybody else does. I read your question.
I think we've lost them. Kevin, are you still? Which 44?
I'm just trying to ring through to get somebody on to see if we can straighten this line up. Are you on?
he's just trying to see if Carter's still on.
Thank you.
Yes, okay. I think... Happy to have done it, I guess.
When you have... I guess you're going to be tied up next week and not free to talk to 63.
Wait just a minute. We're back in here. There was a question asked, Jerry.
Right.
The line dropped out. You want to go ahead and repeat that question, John?
If I may. We've had actually about three questions in the last couple of minutes while the lines were out. But the first one was, how long do you think it'll take to do the majority of the analysis on the data we've got at the moment? How many years? And at the end of that period of time, Dr. Soffin, are you thinking of staying with Mars or going to some other planet, transferring your allegiance to some other planet? And lastly, have we learned anything other unusual about the poles since the orbit's been changed to look at that area?
Okay, let me try it one at a time. I believe it'll be about a year before this data really begins to see the fruition. You know, that's about how long science takes. You just don't do science overnight. We've been so busy pushing commands up and pulling signals back that we really haven't had a chance to do that. I have scheduled here in Boston next September an international symposium on Mars. Any of you are in the States, then by all means, I hope you're going to be able to come. And that will be kind of our really grand scale look at what we've done. That is about a year from now. And we'll really kind of say, what have we learned from the whole thing? We'll have a 4-day session on it. So it'll be a rich kind of give you my time scale. My allegiance to Mars? Well, you have to realize I've been married to Mars a long time, and until I see what this data looks like, I'm not ready to give up Mars. I think there's an enormous amount to be done. I guess it's sort of like asking Cook if he was tired of the Pacific the first time he sailed around there. There's no question that South Pacific we still haven't done it all, let alone that first voyage. So I still think there's a great deal to be done on Mars. And what was your last question?
The last one was, has anything particular been found in the last few weeks about the poles?
Well, it has. It's hard to do this without the pictures themselves. The pictures have made a very dramatic change in our views of what the poles, not what they're made of, but what they look like. You remember when we went looking for sand dunes all through our landing site? Well, we sure have found sand dunes. I tell you, I have seen 10,000 miles of sand dunes, and they're right up against the edge of the pole. It looks absolutely beautiful, just as though you crossed the desert with an airplane. You look down, and as far as picture after picture after picture has sand dunes, there we were looking for sand dunes during Viking 2, and sure, they showed up on the pole. I guess our theories probably just didn't extend far enough. We knew they were in the north, we just didn't know how far north. They're up more like 75, 80 degrees rather than 45, 50 degrees. You watch for the pictures and you'll see what I mean when I say it. It takes seeing the pictures in order to change your mind about what the poles really mean, how they're really constructed.
Fantastic, we hadn't heard that.
Tom, any more from Tid?
No, I think so, Lope.
Okay, Jerry, I think that's all the questions we can think of at the present time. You've handled them, as always, very well. And speaking on behalf of everyone here, I'm sure I'd like to say thanks very much for devoting this much time to us, telling us what's going on, and making it sound simple, as you always do. I'll let the other stations sign off one by one, then.
Big and Nascom, thank you very much.
Space Projects Bridge, thank you.
This is 4-4, Jerry, thank you very much.
I think we're all talking to thin air, actually.
You did a bit of it.
This is Deacon. I think the line's been taken down.
Okay.
I'll terminate.
4-4 out.